This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Yes, Buzzkillers, here we are, fortunately, with Catherine Grace Katz, the author of The Daughters of Yalta, The Churchills, Roosevelts, and Harrimans, A Story of Love and War. It's all about the Yalta Conference in 1945. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, this is such an important book, and we know that the book is doing well because it came out in 2020, and this is already 2021, and is being received well and selling well. How do you feel about how it's gone so far?
I've been thrilled with the reception to the book so far. I am so excited, after having lived with this story in my head for so long, to finally be able to share it with people. And also the reception has been tremendous, and I am so appreciative and grateful for the fantastic reception, including from a number of people I've admired for a long time.
Can you tell us, can you give the Buzzkillers a sense of what happened at Yalta, why there was a meeting there, and why it was so important? Because it's absolutely crucial, and it's almost always forgotten about.
Sure. The Yalta Conference took place in the beginning of February 1945. And at this point in the war in Europe looks like it's drawing to a close after half a decade. It's finally, you know, probably by sometime in the spring, early summer, that they're looking at victory in Europe. The Battle of the Bulge has just ended. But the war in the Pacific is still not nearly as far along. And in the Pacific, Roosevelt doesn't yet know if the atomic bomb will be an option. Iwo Jima has not yet happened. But as they're looking at the end of the war, especially in Europe, the three Allied leaders, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, decide that they need to have a meeting to start to hammer out the details of some of the matters to bring the war to an end.
Right.
And four of the main issues that are on the table for them at Yalta are what to do about Germany in the post-war world. Should it be allowed to remain one nation, or should it be broken up into smaller states in hopes that it doesn't rise up in belligerence once again? Then there's the matter of Polish sovereignty. Britain had gone to war in defense of Polish sovereignty at the outset. And unfortunately for Churchill, who wants to be able to return home and look the Polish government in exile in London in the eye and say that they've succeeded at what they set out to do at the outset. But Stalin has boots on the ground with Red Army across Eastern Europe, especially in Poland, and he has a different idea about Poland's future. In the Pacific, Roosevelt especially is determined to bring the Soviet Union into the war. The Soviets and the Japanese have had a pact of neutrality since the beginning of the war. And Roosevelt is looking at a potential ground invasion of the Japanese home islands, which could lead to the deaths of 200,000 American soldiers. And so he wants to save American lives, and in doing so is willing to exchange certain territorial concessions with Stalin. And finally, Roosevelt is determined to bring the Soviet Union into the international community after the common enemy has been defeated. And the way he sees doing this is through the formation of an international peace organization, the United Nations. He also wants to succeed personally where Woodrow Wilson has failed after the First World War. And he wants to secure peace, not an eternal peace, because he knows that that's not possible, but at least a peace of 50 years in Europe. This is what he sees as his legacy to the world, and he wants to make sure that he's able to achieve this objective.
Now, the big three, the big powers, the big Allied powers, have had meetings before during the war. There's Casablanca meeting and on and on. But why choose Yalta? Now, we know, of course, as you say, it is 1945. In theory, they could have gone almost anywhere. But why Yalta? Yalta is not exactly, you know, a crossroads. It's a crossroads in the sort of Middle East, but it's not a crossroads for the rest of everybody.
Yes. So Stalin is looking at the world and looking at how the balance of power has shifted over the course of the war. The Soviet Union is significantly stronger now. The British Empire is significantly weaker. And he recognizes that he holds more cards than to do his Western allies.
Right.
There are certain agreements that they want him to make, and he will have to be willing to give that. And so he's willing to play the stronger hand that he has and wants them to come to him. Part of the reason is because he's paranoid about security. He doesn't mm-hmm. want to leave his security apparatus in the Soviet Union, so he's only willing to travel as far west as its outer bounds. He's also afraid of flying, so he doesn't want to get on a plane. And so he claims that his doctors advise him against traveling because it's bad for his health. And meanwhile, in reality, Franklin Roosevelt is dying of congestive heart failure.
Right.
And he agrees to come all the way from Washington, traveling across the Atlantic Ocean by ship for a week through waters where they're still sighting enemy U-boats, meet with Churchill at Malta, where they then fly over islands that are still inhabited by enemy anti-aircraft units, where they're being shot at on the way, and make it all the way to the Crimea and to Yalta, which had at one time been a beautiful resort town. It had been this Livadia Palace, where they had the conference, was once the summer palace of Tsar Nicholas II. And so it is a beautiful place, but it's a place that has suffered greatly since the Russian Revolution.
Yes, in fact, it had only relatively recently been liberated.
Yes, the Soviets had finally liberated the Nazis from the Crimea in 1944. And during the time that the Nazis held the Crimea, they had used Livadia Palace as their headquarters.
Right.
And when the Soviets pushed them out, they stripped the palace of everything that they could take with them, the furniture, the art, the lamps, the dishes, even down to the doorknobs, which they mm-hmm. could melt down and use for war material. So the Soviets have a Herculean task of completely refitting this palace with the contents of luxurious hotels in Moscow and carting it 1,000 miles south to the Crimea to make it possible to hold this conference there.
And how do they get all that together? I mean, it must have been an enormous task, but also by the time everyone arrives, I mean, maybe Roosevelt and Churchill aren't, you know, completely unrealistic. They'll realize that it's not in the best of shape, but the Soviets are able to sort of make it acceptable.
Yes. So it's, you know, the Soviets are good at one thing in particular, and that's throwing manpower at a problem.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Yes,
so
the famous Eastern Front.
Helps. Yeah. Yes, they use conscripted laborers to help with the modifications, so to speak. The NKVD boss, Leventry Beria, is in charge of the logistics. Not only do they have to outfit the palace with everything, you know, furniture, but also the mundane everyday items like coat hangers and ashtrays, which they just have to requisition out of homes of local people whose lives have been completely destroyed during the war. And so it's this massive effort, and they should be commended for what they were able to achieve in such a short time with such limited resources. But on the other hand, it's one of these moments where what you see on the surface is not really the truth as it is behind the curtain. And it's fascinating to think of, you know, it's these trimmings of splendor. And it's extreme graciousness on the parts of the Soviets, mm-hmm. providing things that are so luxurious that no one would expect in the middle of a war zone, but yet certain just kind of necessities of life, like an adequate number of bathrooms,
right.
that is not provided.
Right.
So there's some amusement that comes out of this as well.
Yeah, well, one's tempted to say Potemkin Village, but that's probably not the best analogy. Well, I mean, you make a very interesting point early in the book, and it's a very good point, that the Roosevelts, the Churchills, the Stalins, and then the Harriman being the American diplomat, they don't bring their wives. Now, it wasn't necessarily de rigueur to bring your wife to every great power conference, but they didn't at this meeting. And you argue that that was a very important part of the sort of diplomatic niceties of the meeting.
Yes, there are a couple of reasons that they don't bring their wives. In Churchill's case, Clementine Churchill does not like to fly. She avoids it whenever possible. But early in the war, they had decided that someone from the family should travel with him when he traveled abroad, in part to be a confidant and protector of sorts, but also to be a chronicler of family history. They know that Winston Churchill wants to write his war memoirs after the war, and so someone from the family should be there to record things that are taking place outside of the negotiations themselves. In Roosevelt's case, he uses somewhat of an excuse, kind of in, you know, his reason to not bring Eleanor with him. He says that he wants to focus on this meeting as being a really productive meeting and not to stretch the Soviets' resources by feeling that they have to be obligated to make this even more splendid, to be hosts kind of yet another level,
mm-hmm.
by feeling that they are obligated to throw festivities where you'd bring the wives and it would be more formal. And he really wants to just kind of stick to business, and so doesn't want to impose that obligation on them.
Yeah, no fancy state dinners and
exactly.
no excursions for the wives to go in that diplomatic world of that time. That was very common.
Yes, and the banquets with the Soviets are already grand enough. They stretch on for hours with myriad toasts, vodka mm-hmm. all around. And so having the wives there would only draw this out even further. However, it kind of works for him to rest on this argument because he also is not in good health at this time. And as well-intentioned as Eleanor is, she is an extremely energetic person. And he really values her and has valued her throughout, you know, his entire presidency for what she contributed, which was so successful. But also, again, kind of looking at not only the limited resources that the Soviets have, but his own limited energy and attention, he wants to be as singularly focused on the task at hand as possible. And so that's why he thinks that his daughter, Anna, is perhaps more suited to what he needs at that moment.
Well, there's a third daughter in this equation. Who's that?
That is Kathleen Harriman. She is the daughter of Averill Harriman, the American ambassador to the Soviet Union. And before that, he had been Roosevelt's lend-lease envoy in London, beginning in 1941, before the United States entered the war. And he's also an extremely successful businessman. He had been the chairman of Union Pacific Railroad, one of the owners of Newsweek magazine, Brown Brothers Harriman, the banking firm, and the founder of the ski resort Sun Valley. His daughter, Kathleen, spent the entirety of the war at his side. They were not close when she was a little girl. Her parents had divorced when she was young. But after her mother's death, when she was a teenager, they developed a really unique relationship where he was not a warm and fuzzy father by any means, but very ahead of his time in wanting his daughters to be involved in his business as much as they wanted to be. And so when he went to London as a lend-lease envoy, he encouraged his daughter to come with him, where she worked in London as a war reporter in the middle of the Blitz. And then when he went to Moscow to become the ambassador, she stayed with him, learned Russian for both of them because he wouldn't have time, and really became his assistant ambassador in many ways. Both of the Harrimans were extremely adventurous, great athletes, tremendous skiers, and Kathleen shows off her skiing prowess when she is living in Moscow. And what's fascinating is that even though many people haven't heard of her before, she was the American woman who had more access to and exposure to Stalin's inner circle than any other American woman in history. And she's only 27 years old at Yalta.
Right. They do seem to be rather young. But there's one daughter, if you will, missing. Stalin doesn't bring his daughter. Why is that? How come this isn't a book
about... He does not bring his daughter.
How come this isn't a book about four daughters?
So unlike the other fathers who really value the unique skills and experiences that the daughters have, which are able, you know, they are able to contribute so successfully to the mission at Yalta and furthering diplomacy, Stalin's daughter Svetlana could be a great asset because she does speak English, which would be very helpful to him. However, he does not like her to interact with foreigners. Winston Churchill met her one time when he visited Moscow. And Stalin brought Svetlana out at that time almost like a prop to kind of tell Churchill, see, I'm a family man too,
right,
which kind of
right.
rang hollow. But Svetlana and her father have a pretty bad relationship at this point. Her mother had committed suicide when she was a young girl. She only learned this when she was a teenager, really kind of blames it appropriately on her father. She has an affair with an older married man who Stalin objects to and sends him off to Siberia. Then she makes a rebellious marriage to one of her classmates when she's only 19 years old, a man named Grigory Morozov, who's Jewish, to which Stalin takes exception. And at the time of Yalta, Svetlana is 19 and pregnant with her first child, and Stalin has never met his son-in-law. So things are not happy in the Stalin household, and Svetlana is not there.
And probably he wouldn't have thought of her. It's not like he considered bringing her and weighed the pros and cons. He probably wouldn't have even entered his mind. It's just she's further out of that sphere than the other women are into their father's sphere.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes. Well, the other fathers really value their daughters and are very ahead of their time in that way. And you didn't think of Winston Churchill necessarily as a feminist, but of the three fathers, he perhaps appreciated the contributions of his wife and daughters more than anyone. They really valued their daughters, while Stalin kind of kept Svetlana at arm's length and really would never have considered bringing her to this type of meeting.
Okay. Well, this is not a book about, you know, how the daughters sweep in and take over the role of Yalta Conference hostesses. It's not a book of how the daughters, you know, make the affair more glittering and more of a social affair. It really is a book about how they help with the diplomacy and how they help their fathers do the work. So if you don't mind, can we take them one by one, Sarah, Anna, and Kathleen, and tell, you know, give us a sort of story, their story about how they contributed, because they actually did contribute to the agreements that were arrived at Yalta.
They did, and I like to think of them as daughter diplomats.
Where yeah, they're not that's there perfect, speaking, yeah.
Yeah, they're not there speaking officially on behalf of their government like somebody from the State Department or Foreign Office might be, but they're in this kind of betwixt and between role where they're able to go places and have conversations with people that are very nuanced and deliver subtle messages, where they speak with the weight of their fathers behind them. And mm-hmm. similarly, they can go places and experience things that their fathers can't and report back with the information about what they've learned and seen, and gives their fathers a different perspective. Each of the daughters' value to their father was a little bit different. Starting with Sarah Churchill, she was 30 years old at the time of Yalta.
Right.
Prior to the war, she had been an actress, which made her very well suited to diplomacy because so much of it is
no, acting. Sure, absolutely.
And when the war broke out, she decided to join the Women's Branch of the Royal Air Force, where she became an aerial reconnaissance intelligence officer. And so she knew the details of Allied operations, especially in the Mediterranean, better sometimes even than Winston did. And he was so proud of her and liked to brag about how well she was doing, sometimes even blowing the secrecy at times.
Yes, that's right. That's one of his traits, yeah.
So this combination of her actress's demeanor and the very specific knowledge that she had about the war and military operations was very valuable to him. And then underlying all of that was a very close bond that they had had since she was a little girl. Mm-hmm. She felt that she understood him and understood the way his mind worked better than anyone, perhaps except for her mother. And she felt that she could walk with him in silent step, as she called it, to follow along with his thoughts, even when he wasn't speaking, and really kind of be this confidant and counselor and conscience for him, helping to gather his emotions and frustrations and the incredible thoughts in his brain and kind of help him make them as productive as possible before he'd go into the conference sessions.
Right.
Almost like a kind of a member of a privy council.
Mm-hmm.
So she was very valuable to him in a variety of roles. And then on top of that, also her, she was a beautiful writer, really had inherited so much of her father's gift for language. And so, as I had mentioned before about the Churchill family wanting a family chronicler to be there at his side, she was also ideally suited for this role.
Yes, I think that's one major thing people don't recognize about Churchill's family dynamics. And we see this in your book, and we see this in Eric Larson's recent book, The Splendid and the Vile. It is very important to him, and in many ways he relies on these people, his wife and his daughter, almost as much as he relies on cabinet members. So what about Anna Roosevelt?
Anna Roosevelt's role was a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
She was the least experienced in foreign policy compared to the other two daughters. She's 38, so she's the oldest, and she's also the only mother among the three of them. But she had never had an opportunity to go with her father to one of his overseas meetings, despite having asked many times. And he had always turned to his sons to help him when he traveled abroad, to help him physically, to be able to stand
sure,
and move.
Yeah, yeah.
And surprisingly, with Roosevelt, you think of him as a very progressive figure, but he was not always as progressive when it came to involving his own daughter in his work the way that the other fathers did.
Mm-hmm.
However, Anna, she had been living in Seattle with her husband, where she had been an editor with him of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, their newspaper. But when her husband joined the army and shipped out to the Mediterranean, she moved home to the White House Christmas time, 1943. And while she was there, she realized that something wasn't quite right about her father. He was slow on the draw, kind of sitting with his mouth hanging open, like he wasn't getting enough air, and just little things. And no one else really seemed to have noticed.
And this is Christmas 43, so it's quite a while before he actually then dies.
Yes, and so she insists that he have a comprehensive medical examination, which he does have that spring, which reveals he has congestive heart failure.
Yeah.
She's sworn to secrecy, can't tell anyone what she knows. And surprisingly, even FDR, he doesn't ask what's wrong with him. He doesn't want to know, and perhaps this kind of willful blindness is what he needs to maintain to be able to continue on to fight the war and win the war.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
Anna takes it upon herself to really become his gatekeeper, to help decide who really needs an audience with the president and who can meet with someone else, even sometimes going so far as to take papers out of his inbox at night and distributing them to others, on top of other things like making sure that he rests, gets enough
yeah.
sleep, changes his diet. And so he knows that she's protecting him from something, even if he doesn't know exactly what that is. And so in January 1945, when they finally agree where they're going to meet at Yalta, Roosevelt cables Churchill, who had taken Sarah with him first to be his aide at the Tehran conference in 1943, mm-hmm. and says, if you're thinking of bringing Sarah to this conference again, I'm thinking of bringing my daughter, Anna. So Anna finally has the opportunity to go with him to one of his great conferences. She knows she's living through a significant moment in the 20th century. But she also knows that this may be one of her last opportunities to be with her father, because she doesn't know how much longer he has to live. And Anna is literally keeping him alive the entire time at Yalta.
Sure, sure. And everyone seems to concentrate on FDR's polio, but no one knew, or at least officially no one knew, about the congestive heart failure at the time. I mean, I know later in 44 and in early 45, even during cabinet meetings, you know, his mouth falls open and he can barely breathe and that sort of thing. But this is quite early on. So it's very clear he needs a family member he can rely on in all kinds of ways to be there with him.
Exactly. In this environment where, you know, there is deceit and espionage and you don't know who you can trust, the chance to have someone that you can trust implicitly to be at your side, to understand what you're grappling with and want to put the best interest of, you know, you, the principal, but also the country first is, you know, invaluable. And to have that person who understands you and your every thought, I think, you know, we all have someone in our life that we turn to mm-hmm. when, you know, we need someone to help us think through the most complicated issues, or, you know, when we are having a crisis in conscience. And that's kind of an unsung hero for all of us. And I think these daughters really play that role for their fathers. And it's a great opportunity to reflect on who those people may be in our own lives mm-hmm. and how valuable they are. And I think that, you know, even though they're not in the conference room per se, they don't have the security clearance to be there in the negotiations. But the words that come out of a principal are often the product of the thoughts and deliberations of many people.
Right.
And those daughters' thoughts and ideas are reflected in their father's words in the conference as much as any other aide or diplomat who they're working with on a daily basis.
Okay, now we know Stalin's daughter is not there, but Harriman's daughter is. And Harriman is, of course, the ambassador to Moscow. So she is sort of the one of the inroads to help Roosevelt and Churchill understand the Soviet thinking.
Exactly. Many of the Western delegates had never been to the Soviet Union mm-hmm. before, had very little exposure to Russia and Russian culture. The United States didn't have diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union for many years after the Russian Revolution mm-hmm. until Roosevelt finally normalizes relations. And people in the United States, just they're not learning Russian as a foreign language. They're not really learning Russian history to the extent that they might be today. And so there's kind of a real void of knowledge. So Kathleen is this liaison where, you know, she has been functioning really as her father's assistant ambassador because she speaks Russian and mm-hmm. she's able to kind of extend his influence. But she's also there in a way that we would almost think of as a protocol officer from the State Department, where she's the liaison between the Soviets and the Americans.
Oh, right.
She knows the British very well from her time in London. The Harrimans became very close friends with the Churchill family during the time that they were living there. So everyone already knows and respects Kathleen. So her father leaves her in Yalta while he goes to Malta first to rendezvous with Churchill and Roosevelt on their way to the Crimea. And Kathleen is the point person working between the Soviet and American advance teams to make sure that everything is just right. Kind of in one of these unsung roles where, you know, a lot of diplomacy is about making sure calamities don't happen. And because they don't happen, the person who is making sure that everything is just so doesn't get the credit for a job well done.
Right, that's right.
And so she is very much in this role, kind of bridging the gap between cultures and also kind of handling the incredibly extensive, you know, logistical arrangements in less than ideal circumstances, trying to figure out where everyone's going to sleep, where everyone is going to bathe in the morning, you know, making sure that, you know, generals who are having to bunk multiple people to a room aren't going to be offended by the circumstances, trying to help people understand, you know, yes, you're going to have to wait for the bathroom in the morning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're all just going to have to put up with that. So she really does this and kind of has that, you know, American practicality with, she's, you know, she's also very glamorous and witty. And so it's, you know, that kind of can-do attitude, which really helps her get through a lot of really difficult experiences that she has, both, you know, in London during the Blitz when she was a reporter, and then in Moscow during the second half of the war with her father.
How did you analyze what sort of solid contribution they made to the agreements at Yalta? I mean, I doubt very much, having worked in historical primary sources all my adult life, that, you know, Churchill writes in his diary, oh, by the way, thanks to my daughter, we wouldn't have gotten this agreement about the Japanese part if it hadn't been for her. I don't think anyone is as direct as that, but there must have been evidence used. Otherwise, this book wouldn't be as rich as it is.
Exactly. So some of it is coming from the letters and diaries of the daughters themselves. Mm-hmm. Sarah Churchill writing to her mother about kind of the day-to-day experiences being there with her father, sitting up with him late into the night, talking about the concerns that he has about the upcoming meetings with Stalin and Roosevelt, especially regarding Poland, and how he feels that Roosevelt just doesn't understand the gravity of the situation. And so she's really kind of helping her father bring his thoughts together in the most productive way possible, especially in the face of the great frustration that Roosevelt isn't seeing eye to eye with him, and that the bond that they had shared, which was so strong throughout the war, seems to be fraying. For Anna, a lot of it has to do kind of with the aspects of Roosevelt's health and the impact that she's having, kind of literally, again, keeping him alive at the time.
Right.
And so he's not having as many of the kind of late night conversations about policy with her, but Anna and the cardiologist, who's also there, are working tirelessly to make sure that he stays alive and also to make sure that the secret of his ill health remains a secret.
Right.
It's one of many secrets that she's carrying on his behalf, but she's also kind of running interference sometimes to keep people from meeting with him who she feels are going to exhaust him, including Churchill.
Yes, and Churchill's famous for exhausting Roosevelt. Yeah.
Yes, but for better or for worse, the meetings when Churchill and Roosevelt are able to present a united front had been extremely successful throughout the war. And Roosevelt kind of allows Anna to keep Churchill at an arm's length at this time because he is trying to pursue this bond with Stalin and a future relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. And he wants to do this kind of on a one-on-one basis with Stalin without Churchill as part of the conversation, and whether or not that was detrimental or what impact it had to Allied relations in the long run, I'm not sure. And so you kind of have Anna in this uncomfortable role where she is interfering in some of the leaders' conversations and some conversations that perhaps they should have had. And so trying to balance that impact and really kind of FDR allowing her to be in that role, and if there's blame that should be assigned, it should be on him, but really kind of balancing with, everything she's doing just to keep him alive through the end of the conference. Because without her, who knows, he may have died on the way there at the conference, or perhaps even on the way home.
And what about the Harriman connection? I mean, she's, after all, the most diplomatic of the three. Can we chalk any more successes up to her than the other two? Or is it again, a problem of weighing the some of the unknowns?
Kathleen Harriman, she is, again, kind of this one person that her father can trust in a place where people are being eavesdropped on all the time. I mean, the Soviets have bugged their quarters, and this is something that the Harrimans have been living with for the last 2 years. And so at this point, FDR and Harriman are not seeing eye to eye on how to proceed with the Soviet Union, whether that you can take their word for the agreements that they're making at Yalta, their intentions towards Poland. And Harriman is very frustrated with FDR at this point, really has come to be much more like-minded with Churchill. And his daughter is perhaps one of the reasons that he has come to have this view, because when she was a reporter in London, one of her assignments was to cover the press conferences with exiled European leaders, specifically the Polish government in exile. Mm-hmm. So she heard very early warning signs from them as early as 1941 and 1942 that this relationship that you have with the Soviets, kind of a marriage of necessity, is not like doing business with any other Western power.
Right.
Harriman had kind of discounted that, had some business dealings with the Soviet Union prior to the Great Depression and the war. And so he thinks it will be kind of a transactional business-like relationship. And so Kathleen early on is trying to say, given what the Poles are telling me, this is not quite the case. And so she's writing to her sister at the time, expressing her frustration that her father doesn't see what she is hearing. And it's really only after they move to the Soviet Union and they experience the aftermath of the Warsaw Uprising, where the Poles tried to overthrow the Nazis, the Soviets watch on the other side of the river, only moving in at the end when 25% of the Polish population in Warsaw had been slaughtered.
Right.
And so finally he sees what his daughter had been seeing much earlier in the war.
Well, I'd like to end with, because I always want to impress our readers with how interesting and how difficult it is to do the research for these sorts of books. A lot of the things you were able to discover, and I really mean discover, sort of happened by chance or by happenstance. And the stories you've told me in our emails and stuff setting up this interview about finding the sources and how many of these letters and how many of these sources have only recently been opened were all fascinating.
Yes. I had, you know, been a history major in college and studied history in graduate school. And like many recent grads, had decided to do what I thought was a smart thing and went to work in finance in New York. Yeah. But by sheer coincidence, in the lobby of my office was a bookstore called Chartwell Booksellers, which is named after Churchill's country home. And I used to sneak down there when I just couldn't take the Excel modeling anymore and got to know the owner. And he introduced me to the Churchill family and the International Churchill Society. And it was around that time that they were opening Sarah Churchill's papers to outside researchers for the first time.
Right.
So I had a chance to be one of the first people to look at her papers, which had not been open to the public before, and write an article about them. Mm-hmm. And through the Churchill family, I was able to connect with Kathleen Harriman's family. And she had only passed away in 2011. And she really didn't talk about her experiences during the war, you know, very much like the rest of her generation, very humble, didn't think what she'd done was any more important than anyone else.
Right.
And so it was really only after she died that her sons discovered these scrapbooks and letters that she'd had during the war and began to piece together what a remarkable life she had led. And so then through them, I was able to connect with Anna Roosevelt's children. And so it was kind of, you know, one thing led to another. And many of these papers had really never been seen before. And I think that in previous scholarship, if the daughters are mentioned at all, it's kind of as a light aside in the midst of lengthy tracts on the geopolitical negotiations themselves.
Right.
But I think people had been missing the importance of these women, their contributions to the Yalta Conference, and also the great importance that they had in their fathers' lives, and the fact that these relationships were some of the most important among any of the world. But a lot of it was because we didn't know how much of an impact they'd had because their papers had not been available. So I was very fortunate to be able to, you know, comb through these letters, these diaries, interview family members, one of Winston Churchill's secretaries who's still alive. So really kind of this wonderful inflection point between discovering new materials and also being able to interview people who knew and loved them more than anyone.
Yeah, one of the reasons we're able to keep writing history and keep talking about history is because new stuff literally comes to light. Brand new, you know, unseen stuff. Is always being discovered.
Or things that you didn't realize were there but had been right under your nose the whole time, because the times in which we're living today makes us reevaluate and see the past in a different way.
Well, that's a perfect way for us to wrap up the episode. So it's all, it just remains for me to say thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great fun.
And Buzzkillers, the book is obviously, The Daughters of Yalta is obviously on the Buzzkill bookshelf where you can get it. And we will say to all of you out there that we will talk to you next week.